Welcome back to Copper Country Today. I'm your host, Rick Allen. Joining me in the studio right now, candidate for State Senator Ed McBroom. Ed's good to talk to you. Actually, good to finally meet you after these few years. Of course, you're a state representative, a former state representative from the Upper Peninsula to just to our south here. But
that's
now
right.
with Tom Casperson being term limited and that seat coming open, you've got your eye on that. So let me start with just so we have, since we haven't had a chance to get to know you a little bit, tell me just a little bit about yourself and your background.
Well, thanks very much for having me, Rick. Good morning. I'm a dairy farmer my whole life, been born and raised. We used to milk about 45, 50 cows when I was real little. We're doing 125 now. I farm with my parents and my wife and my wife's sister, who was married to my brother, who we farmed together, my brother and I, for many years, but he was killed this summer in an accident. And so,
sorry.
Oh, thank you. So I have five kids and he has eight. And so it's a busy place. And, you know, we're very proud of the opportunity, very blessed to be raising kids there on the farm and working together. And,
You still actively farm.
Oh yeah. Exactly. Came from there this morning. Had another calf born, two calves this morning, and you know, keep moving. We've got corn to harvest and field work to do. But my dad and my brother and all of my family are very supportive of me being involved with politics. And in a lot of ways, it's because we want to protect and preserve the way of life that we have up here in the UP, that we have on the farm. And when I first ran in 2010, it was really under attack by certain folks within the administration at that time and within the bureaucracies in Lansing. And so I went down there to be a part of the solution. And my family still really supports my activities with that. And, you know, I still believe that can make a difference both for agriculture, for education, and for other issues that are really important to keeping and preserving our way of life here in the Upper Peninsula.
When you were in Lansing, how well represented was UP values and our needs in Lansing?
Well, it's always very challenging because there's four for sure from the UP and sometimes six, but in my whole time there, it was only ever four because a couple of districts straddle the bridge, and so the rep can be from either side. Sometimes we get steamrolled. You know, sometimes the UP issues just get steamrolled. Energy is a prime example of that. That was the very last issue in my final term in the House, and John Keevil and I had worked out a pretty good deal, and then all of a sudden they didn't need our votes anymore, and they steamrolled us, and sometimes that happens, and you fight for it, and you fight, and sometimes you lose. But a lot of times, our team up here did really make a significant difference, and the four of us were able to build coalitions and pull people together. And you know, whether it was on the wolf issue or on the terrible freeze-ups that we had and the propane crisis that we had in 2014, we worked very hard and brought that message to Lansing and got a lot of attention for that, and were able to get special projects back in the district. So, you know, it bounces back and forth, and you learn to, you know, who you can trust and who you can't trust and how to make those teams and those partnerships last and work. Tom Casperson was a real leader in that for so many years. I mean, he's just a great advocate for the Upper Peninsula and worked very hard and, you know, was the one senator we had from the UP. And so in that chamber, he was that voice for the UP. And that's what I'm trying to go to continue that really good work.
When I think back to those years that you served in the legislature, those sort of hot topic items, of course, the new health care law, you know, if you started in 2010, yep. Michigan's involvement with that. Of course, the governor's been very supportive with, you know, Michigan taking part in that. Also, the effort to try to get funding for the roads, which should have, you know, this should be solved. We passed road funding.
Yes.
These are still some problems that you will again have to pick up and look after if you make it into the state Senate.
Yeah, the road funding one is a particularly difficult issue because the way Michigan has road funding set up is just terrible. The fact that when you go to the gas pump, that sometimes over half of the taxes you pay at the pump don't get to roads, they go somewhere else, is a huge problem with the setup, because it's very easy to see that we pay more taxes per gallon than most other states do. But we also spend the least per gallon on roads than most states do. And trying to find a solution to that, especially in this term limited era where every rep comes in freshman year, we're going to fix this by going after waste, fraud, and abuse. We won't have to raise any revenue. And, you know, slowly you learn as you do a budget or two that it's like, well, we need $1 billion or more to fix roads in Michigan, and it's getting worse all the time. And I could eliminate entire departments, not just go in and find some waste, fraud, and abuse within departments, but I could eliminate whole departments and not even get 10% of the money that we need to do the roads better. And you look at how that funding is set up and you start to try to figure out ways that you can fix that and make it a better system. But 2 years go by, suddenly another class of freshmen come in and there's 40 to 60 new people, maybe even a majority, who haven't had that experience yet. And so they still come in thinking they're going to get it from where you thought you were going to get it from. And that cycle is just repeat, repeat. Finally, in my last term, we were able to pass some road funding. I was able to offset the increase that people are paying at the pump with an amendment that increased the homestead property tax credit that offset the increase for most folks. And so that's why I was supportive of that, because property taxes are just out of control and very regressive. And road funding should go to roads. And then we also are using more of the general fund for roads, and that's ramping up. And you're starting to see that. Of course, this year's been tough because there's been a strike amongst the workforces, or a lockout.
Labor lockout, yep.
And but there's so many more projects, and there's so many more projects in the queue that are going to get funding as that funding's ramping up in the next several years. So the difference is coming. It's out there. But there's still going to be more to do. And as long as we're in these exceedingly short terms, we have the shortest term limits in the country, it's always going to be very tumultuous to make these really important critical changes to structures of government, whether it's road funding or school funding, property tax issue, the dark store loopholes, another prime example of, is in this term limited era, it's difficult to make those large scale generational changes that we need.
The funding for repairing the roads, mm-hmm. that, of course, what especially Houghton County here, you know, suffered so much during the floods of this summer.
Yes.
One of the things that local leaders are hoping to be able to get is a little bit more additional assistance from the state legislature, perhaps in a special appropriations after the elections. Is that something that, you know, you could see? Is it feasible? Is it really?
I think it's pretty likely. I know Senator Casperson's working very hard on that. I think that that's likely to happen. It's what they call supplemental appropriation, and there'll be a number of other things in there. But this is certainly at the top of the list for him and for the governor and others that are there.
Okay. Let's talk about some of the other things that, you know, we know that's going to, the legislature is going to have to be able to tackle. One has been going on for a few years, and that's in reform to our car insurance.
Absolutely. You
know, among those things that always kind of strikes me is when I see, you know, Michigan, you know, being among the highest in car insurance rates, and it doesn't matter if you're in Wayne County or not. And I used to live in Wayne County. Mm-hmm. I knew, you know, I kind of expect to pay a higher insurance rates when you live near the major city like that. But, you know, all throughout Michigan, it's a, you know, an issue. We're all paying a lot for our car insurance.
Yeah, it's terrible, and it's very unfair. It's particularly a tax on all of us, but a tax on poor people more than any, because they have a car that's not worth insuring with collision or comprehensive, and yet they still pay $1,000 to $2,000 a year. Young people, this is happening to them. And then if there's an accident and the car is ruined, they don't get anything for that investment. They have to go out and buy another junky car and keep paying high insurance rates. It's terrible. All along the border of the Upper Peninsula, I know families who've moved their children out of state into Wisconsin, close by neighborhoods, because the car insurance is so expensive in Michigan. It doesn't make any sense. And so it's easier to rent a room over there and save that money. So we're losing population even here. And in Detroit, it's even worse. For the city itself, folks will purposefully get an address or something outside the city limits so they can get a lower insurance rate. And so the city of Detroit is very concerned moving into the next census that they're going to have a further population drop, even though technically more people are living there in the city now. And it's because of car insurance. And really, there's three parts of it when it comes to car insurance. You've got the no fee schedule on medical procedures. If you break a wrist in the bathtub or you break one in a car, it could be a difference between $400 or $4,000. Car insurance is just unchecked. So we could make real strides in saving us money by going after that fee schedule. It could be reflective workman's comp. It could be more than workman's comp, but it needs to be some sort of scheduled fees. We need to take on the unlimited lifetime benefits issue and offer people choices. Do you want that much coverage? Especially senior citizens who already have the coverage through Medicare. Why are they buying this expensive additional policy for that? That doesn't make sense. And then thirdly, the attendant care is so abused by the attorneys who fight for these cases and skim off of the top, and folks are able to get a $30 an hour settlement. The attorneys take $3 or $4 off of that for themselves. And it's per hour, every hour of the day, every day of the week, every day of the year. So, you know, if you're looking at, you know, somewhere around $260,000 a year to stay home and take care of a loved one whose medical expenses and those charges are still already taken care of for them. And it's a nice thing to do, but it's bankrupting all the rest of us. It's a system that's not sustainable. And even the actuarials will show you that they think currently we need $60 billion and the fund only has $20 billion in it. And you know, anybody who says, well, let's just go after the fraud in the system, which we should definitely do, that's not going to save us money. If we're paying some police force of some sort to go after the fraud, why don't we instead reduce the incentive to commit fraud in the first place? That's going to be what really saves us the money. So we should definitely go after fraud, but we should also reduce the reason why fraud gets committed. And we certainly shouldn't pass legislation that says, oh, by the way, if you commit fraud and we catch you, you can still collect your benefits anyway. And that's what one of the proposals out there right now is saying. And that's just ridiculous.
Opponents for the type of reform that you're talking about have stated that you're eliminating a lot of the benefits of, you know, like the lifetime medical benefits, but the actual reduction in insurance will only be a matter of a few dollars, and the trade-off wasn't worth it.
So I know that's what they've been saying, but if you look at the bill that was voted on about a year ago, and that my opponent voted no on, the bill mandated specifically that if you still chose a $250,000 coverage, which is five times better than any other state, because New York's got the next highest at $50,000. So we were going to offer people $250,000 coverage. It mandated a 40% savings. So that's a huge amount of money for a lot of folks who are paying well over $2,000 a year to save 40%. That could easily be $1,000 a year for a lot of us up here. That's real money. You go down to Detroit, where they're sometimes paying over $4,000 to $5,000 a year, 40% was going to be a big deal for those folks. It was going to help people get back on the road, have that car, get to work. So I know people are saying, oh, this reform only saves a few dollars, but I don't know how you can say that when it said right in the law to the insurance companies, hey, you must reduce rates by this amount, which I'm not generally supportive of the government setting rates, but when the government's mandating insurance coverage in the first place, then it feels like we ought to be able to control those costs too. So people who say there was no controls there, I just don't understand how they can say that and read that bill and say that in good faith.
All right, let's move on to some of the other topics. One is, you know, the education in Michigan. You know, I grew up believing that Michigan was, you know, among the leaders in education. I certainly got a great education mm-hmm. living in Plymouth, Michigan,
sure.
And had quite a few opportunities for myself, you know, available to go to college, and also had plenty of financing mm-hmm. Through whether it was federally backed loans or other options. Plus, I also earned scholarship money for myself as well to make, you know, to reduce the amount it would cost me to go to college. Things have changed now. You know, number of years later, people are, you know, they have a tremendous amount of student debt, and legislators are looking for ways to try to ease that. Those on the opposite side of the aisle, the Democrats, have repeatedly introduced ways to offer free education, at least through community college, maybe even some 4-year, depending on your income levels. Your response is that movement, which is going to continue, I'd imagine.
Yeah, there's obviously, you know, ideas out there nationally, you know, it's free education and all, but nobody ever really talks much about how we're going to pay for it unless they're willing to talk about the dramatic tax increases that would come along with that. For me, something that's been much more passionate for me when it comes to education is that we do a better job in the high school level helping students to figure out where they want to go with these career paths. Do they want to go on to a four-year college, or do they have an interest in something else? And stopping the continual turnover of students that we just pump out to the four-year colleges, and then within a year or two, they're gone. Or they go and they're undeclared for 5-6 years and run up these big debts trying to decide what did I want to major in. If you go to the university, they're very encouraging to be undeclared. Oh, that's no problem. Just be undeclared for a long time. Well, that's not saving folks money, and that's making education more expensive. And so we need to do a better job at the school level helping students figure out what they want to do. And I think that would save us and reduce a lot of the waste and the spending that we have. Obviously, it's important to the state as a whole to be investing more in education, and I have voted for a lot of increases, both for the university and for the K-12. But I'm passionate about seeing us return more control at the local level to the professionals that are at our schools in determining what are these kids going to study? What's a career path that would allow them to stay here if they want to, or to come back here later on, instead of just making a cookie cutter, one size fits all education, which is what the state created with the merit curriculum in 2004. Let's get back to that opportunity where the locals set up the graduation requirements, the primary requirements to get out of school, and help them by providing more guidance counselors, by providing more opportunities to students to explore the careers that are available around here, to get out of the classroom, to see, am I interested in the medical profession, in the radio profession, being a farmer? Do I want to work, be an electrician or a plumber? There's so many opportunities, and yet if you look at how the state has cramped the whole school day up, tied it in knots with testing and with class requirements and all this other stuff, even talk to a university about how difficult it is to go in and recruit at the high schools now. The time is just gone, and we could do a lot better, and I think provide a lot more opportunity for where students want to go. We also should be doing a lot more for adult education, because students, not everybody's very mature at 18. Not everybody's ready to be an adult at 18. And when they suddenly wake up in mom's basement at 25 and say, boy, I wish I had finished high school, we don't provide a lot of support anymore for them. And we used to, and we should bring that back.
Just to touch on your thing, point there, people should not go into radio. it's a tough gig, but... other people, though, are...
Farming is, too.
Yeah. You're not going to get rich by doing either one of them. What about the trade schools that, yeah, you know, we're seeing a big push on that. They've got a great program over here at Jeffers High School that, mm-hmm, you know, it's acknowledging that, you know, rather than going to the university and coming out with one of those humanities degrees, not to say anything right about humanities, if you can turn it into a career, but a lot of students struggle turning, yes, that into a career. When, you know, there are jobs paying $20, $30 an hour doing skilled trades, and that these are jobs that are in high demand.
That's right. And that's exactly what I'm talking about. And when I first got to Lansing in 2011, I worked on and was very fortunate by 2014 to have got a legislation that opened a tiny window up in the merit curriculum, allowed students to opt out of 1 year of foreign language if they were taking a vocational or technical program, allowed them to take some of their math built into the curriculum over at the tech centers. But it was just a tiny window, and it didn't really allow freedom for all the students. What about the student who wants to study music? They're no longer really in their schedule able to fit both band and choir. And instead, we say, nope, you've got to take these classes over here that might not be relevant to you. So whether it's in the arts or in the career tech, going to the skilled trades, we're still really, really hampering access to that. Schools used to often have a college preparatory track and a career tech vocational track. And even within those, the local school district had some ability to help the student by specializing that curriculum. And the state really cracked down on that in 2004 because some schools were abusing it. Why can't we give that authority back to the schools that aren't abusing it? Why do we always have to make our schools up here jump through the hoops to save some school downstate that's doing a bad job.
Right now, Michigan has a Republican-controlled House and State Senate. We also have a Republican governor right now. A lot can change come November. Mm-hmm. Just so looking at these, this time that you've been out of the state legislature, has there been things that you've found frustrating that you wish you would have had, you know, maybe a little bit, that be able to have some involvement, things that have happened over the last couple of years?
Well, you know, when you first start, you're just like drinking from the fire hydrant, right? You know, you just get down there and it's difficult and you're not sure who to trust and you don't know exactly how you solve problems. So somebody calls you up, they need help. You just call everybody. Help me out with this constituent issue or help me with this policy issue. A few years into it, you start to learn, okay, these are the people I can trust. Here's how the system works. Here's who I call. Here's who I don't bother to call. And so I miss helping people in that regard. And I especially miss that towards my last term, I really felt like I was doing a good job and was able to help a lot of people. And I was able to move a lot of issues forward. I became the chief, the committee chair of the oversight committee, headed up the investigation into the abuses at the Grand Rapids Veterans Home, headed up the House's investigation into the Flint water crisis, worked on the unemployment agency's fraud issues and was head of that investigation. I was really into trying to hold departments and government accountable, introduced Freedom of Information Act expansions to the governor's office and the legislature. I think there's so much opportunity to make government work better, but then all of a sudden my time was over. And so sitting on the outside looking in and watching what they're doing and saying, oh, if we could have made this change, if I could have worked on this some more. And I missed that. And I miss helping folks who still call me up. And, you know, I still try to make those connections that I have for them to one of the reps or one of the senators. But I look forward to doing that again. What really still troubles me, though, is that oftentimes the agencies, the bureaucracy, does not work for the people and has its own agenda. Oftentimes they're lobbied just as much or more than legislators are by special interest groups. And I want to continue to push back on that to make sure that the voice of the people through their elected leaders is the voice that makes laws that we follow and not policy directives from some department who's got personnel who've got personal opinions on how it should be done. Prime example when I first got there was what they were trying to do to Roger Turnin in Baraga by trying to take his pigs away from him because he didn't have the pretty pink pigs. He had the pigs that they don't like, and somebody decided they don't like those kind of pigs. And we fought and fought. Governor Granholm had initiated the removal of them, and we tried to stop that. And due somewhat to me being brand new at the time, I suppose, but also because of the forces that were aligned against us, we were unsuccessful. Now Roger's in court fighting it. I hope he can remain victorious. But how can the government work to steal people's private property? That's wrong. And they do that to us up here, not just on stealing personal property like pigs, but what they do to us by restricting access to lands and trails and making it hard for us to continue to live here and enjoy the way of life we have and scooping up land and some of the preserves and things, the land groups that buy land and are affecting our ability to enjoy the Upper Peninsula and it's certainly affecting our community's abilities to function. You look at Baraga County and how much of that is owned by the state. It makes it almost impossible to develop things and to make things happen. So we need to continue to fight those fights, and I'm very passionate about that.
We probably are more divided now than it just as well as just any other time of we've politically than in this country now. I don't want to say it's the most because we've had some other times we've been pretty politically divided. Mm-hmm. But certainly right now it's very hard to get Republicans and Democrats to work together. And that's at the state level as much as it is on the national level. What would you say to your ability to work with, the legislator that maybe is diametrically opposed to your values?
Well, I mean, I wished it was, you know, that some of them were closer by here so you could hear how well I worked together with folks from both sides of the aisle. John Kivla and I got along very well and did a lot together. And you could see that partnership that we had and how we worked together on a lot of things. It's, you know, even with Scott and Tom, the four of us made a good team because the UP was more important to us than party most of the time for most of us. I wish I could run as an independent because party is just not that important to me. It's the issues. It's doing the right thing for people. You can look at my record and see plenty of times when I went against the party because they were wrong. And you can see times when I went against both parties because they were both wrong, which is oftentimes, especially in education. One of the very first votes I ever had to deal with was on the Telecom Act. And I was just shocked. I thought for sure I was going to be with a whole bunch of Democrats all voting no as to what this bill was doing. And then it was six of us total who voted no. And I went over to Steve Lindbergh, who was the Marquette rep at the time. I'm like, what's going on? I thought you guys would certainly be against this. And, it was a learning curve, learning how that works and how leadership drives certain members to choose certain ways to vote. And it's not always the lobbyists. It's oftentimes the leadership. I learned how to fight that and stand against it. I'm very proud of that work and still believe that I can go down and be that independent voice for us in the UP.
25 minutes goes by pretty quick. Ed, if somebody wants to learn more about your campaign, what's the best way to do that?
You can go to my webpage, mcbroomforsenate.com, and check it out, or other ways, look me up, and I'm around
Thank you so much for taking the time today.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Rick.
Copper Country Today, we'll be right back.